This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Let's get to what, as you know, is our top national story, the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore after a container ship struck it, sending nearly the entire roadway structure crumbling into the water. President Biden addressing the incident earlier from the White House.
I told them we're going to send all the federal resources they need as we respond to this emergency. I mean, all the federal resources. And we're going to rebuild that port together. Everything so far indicates that this was a terrible accident. At this time, we have no other indication, no other reason to believe there's any intentional act here.
All right. That, of course, was President Biden earlier from the White House. For the latest, let's head to Bloomberg co-host of Balance of Power, Kelly Lyon. She is on site in Baltimore. Kelly, a lot going on and new information, obviously, about this situation continues to come out. So what's the latest? Get us up to speed.
Well, Carol, right now this is still an active search and rescue effort, and officials here say that is still the number one priority. What we know is that at the time this happened, 1:30 a.m. Eastern time, when the dolly collided with the structural support of the bridge and it all came crashing down, there was a construction crew on the bridge working on fixing potholes, and a number of individuals fell into the water. Two have been rescued, one of which is hospitalized, but there are still six individuals unaccounted for. So that is really what everyone is focused on most immediately, is that rescue operation. Then, of course, it will turn to other questions, including the clearing of the debris so that this port, a very busy port of Baltimore, may be able to get back open at some point in time. And of course, then there's the other effort of reconstructing this bridge. But again, there is no clear timeline. We heard as much from the Maryland Governor Wes Moore when he spoke to reporters earlier today. He really emphasized that the focus right now is on saving lives. He did not put a timeline on anything. And in the interim, traffic, commuter traffic, goods getting shipped over the roads and goods getting shipped in transit by the waterways here around Baltimore are going to be disrupted.
Kaylee, we did hear from the president that everything so far indicates that this was a terrible accident. What do we know about the accident? What do we know about the ship? What do we know about the crew on the dolly and just how this happened?
Well, the dolly, of course, is a ship that was Singapore flagged, had been chartered by Maersk, and was carrying cargo of Maersk customers. Now, what is the law here in Maryland is that the ship actually needed to be piloted in Maryland waters by authorities from the state. So that was would have been in charge of the vessel at the time this happened. But our understanding at this point, based on the briefings reporters have received from authorities, is essentially that there was a power outage. They lost propulsion, the ability to control the vessel, and they did notify port authorities here in Maryland of that. So Wes Moore, actually, the governor, talked in the briefing about how authorities did have time to make sure that no more vehicles came onto the bridge. They were able to halt more traffic because they did get warning, a mayday from the ship, that this was happening. But ultimately, this was a ship, according to the governor, that was traveling at 8 knots speed, relatively fast, considering they were just coming down the river, and ultimately could not be stopped from colliding into the structural support. So again, as we heard from the president, as we've heard repeatedly from other authorities, really just looks like a terrible, tragic accident that, of course, will have consequences, human, most immediately, regionally, and even nationally as well.
Kaylee, you've been on the ground for a few hours. Just describe the scene and what you've been noticing over that time frame.
Well, there are hundreds of people here, Carol. Obviously, a very large media presence from local media here in the DMV area to national media, as well as there have been other trucks, things carrying equipment, even some trailers up to the point of the road that we at least are able to see. Of course, the road ultimately just hits a dead end and there is nothing beyond it because of that part of the bridge had collapsed. But starting to see some equipment coming in. And of course, I am watching really at this hour for any time now. This Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg is expected to be here on site at the invitation of Governor Moore to work with authorities here as this effort is underway. He will likely reiterate a lot of what we've already heard from President Biden in terms of the federal government providing support, not just to the search and rescue effort, but the reconstruction effort as well, and any funding that that might require. And even more immediately, I would point out at 2:30 p.m. Eastern time, we are expecting right here behind me, the NTSB to be delivering a briefing to the press. And of course, we'll keep all updated on those developments as we get them.
Yeah, and we will take those briefings live as we do get them. Hey, Kaylee, I know you mentioned it's a search and rescue operation is what's happening right now. That is that is our focus. And the other questions will certainly come later. It does raise questions about what happens to shipping out of Baltimore what happens on the global shipping front. What can you tell us about the importance of the port and where some of the port traffic will go and how this could snarl a really delicate balance when it comes to global trade?
Yeah, of course, we're all still reeling from the supply chain impacts we saw during COVID-19. And in some ways, that may make actually more cargo operators and those coordinating these shipments to be a little bit more prepared and being able to reroute things. But that will likely be necessary. And frankly, for an unknown period of time, as you allude to, Tim, this is a very important port. It is actually the busiest port in the country and has been for 13 years in a row in terms of the import and export of automobiles, of vehicles, cars, light trucks. Almost 850,000 of them went through this port in 2023, and that is now going to be likely heavily disrupted. We already, of course, have heard from the Ford executive speaking on Bloomberg earlier, talking about how they're going to need to reroute some things in terms of car parts, for example. GM has indicated they'll have to reroute as well. And it's not just the auto industry that could be affected here. There's also a number of key commodities that come in and out of this port, one being coal. We're talking tens of millions of tons per year. That could be disrupted in terms of those exports for an unknown period of time. Really, there's just a lot of transit, seaborne transit in particular, that is going to have to go elsewhere, whether that's north to places like New Jersey and New York and those ports there, or south to the likes of Norfolk in Virginia. But there's going to have to be movement around, and that's just in terms of what moves over water. Of course, there is a huge part of I-695 that is now collapsed and is also submerged, and ground traffic, commuter traffic, and just freight distribution is going to be disrupted as well.
All right, going to leave it there. Hey, Kaylee, thank you so much. Bloomberg co-host of Balance of Power, Kaylee Lyons. And we want to continue on the shipping impact and the significance of this port in Baltimore. It is one of the busiest ports, as we heard from Kaylee, on the U.S. East Coast. With more on that side of the story, let's bring in Bloomberg News trade czar Brendan Murray joining us from London. Brendan, we know this is a major distribution hub, the biggest in Maryland. Specifically, share with us some more about size and scope and the significance of this port to the U.S. supply chain.
Yeah, it's not a giant port for containers, but as your previous guest mentioned, there are some there's a diverse array of products that and goods that move in and out of Baltimore, cars, coal, gypsum, and a lot of construction equipment. So, you know, and farming equipment. You know, it's we're getting close to planting season for farmers. We're getting close to sort of spring construction season. So those kinds of things could cause some logistical snarls or hiccups here in the weeks and months ahead. A lot of this cargo will be diverted to places nearby like New York or Norfolk, Virginia. Although one of the major car terminals that would be an option for Baltimore is in Brunswick, Georgia, and so that's, you know, hundreds of miles to the south. So you can imagine that the delays that are going to be involved in shipping something from Georgia, up the East Coast, as opposed to bringing it into Baltimore. So it's those kinds of wrinkles that are going to have to be worked out over the coming weeks. But you know, they're still sort of untangling the mess. The port itself, some of those auto terminals are on the ocean side of the bridge, so they're not going to be affected. Some of it is on the other side of the bridge, which is apparently going to be closed for a long time. So there's still a lot of details to work out about the extent of the disruptions, but they're going to be some at least minor disruptions for a while, and they may sort of snowball if they can't work these out here over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to talk about. You use terms like hiccups and snarl and wrinkles. At what point do they become bigger disruptions that can affect the greater U.S. and perhaps even global economy? Is that possible with a tragedy like this?
Well, you know, we saw a pretty clear example during the pandemic that an extra 10 or 20% of cargo coming into another port that's not really ready for it can cause major congestion. That's what happened in Los Angeles when a lot of consumer demand in the U.S. picked up, and you kind of had this sort of accordion effect where the rail lines couldn't move the goods out of the port, and then the truckers couldn't move so it just kind of has this domino effect. So we definitely saw that. So if this cargo's got to divert elsewhere, the other ports, if there's not capacity to handle and absorb that extra cargo, then you could see ships backed up. To the extent to which, we don't know yet, but that kind of thing can definitely happen, as we've seen before.
You know, Brendan, too, and I think, and you note this in your story, let's not forget that, distribution warehouses, right? It's always, we talk about it as a great real estate play, a lot of investors do, but nonetheless, there are some massive distribution warehouses from the likes of Amazon, FedEx, Under Armour, Home Depot, car companies, like around that area in particular. So I guess we're all kind of waiting to see what those companies maybe say specifically about that, but that's another aspect to this story.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these distribution centers are, many of them are automated. So, you start throwing curveballs at them like this, and, the whole system can kind of lock up. So there are definitely going to be problems regionally with shipping around Baltimore and the sort of the Philadelphia to Washington corridor. The truck traffic is going to be, hazardous materials have to go over that bridge. That bridge no longer is passable, so it's mm-hmm. going to have to go somewhere else. It can't go through the Baltimore Harbor Tunnel. So, you're looking at, a lot of extra traffic's going to be pushed on different roadways. And, that's the right. middle of the Eastern Corridor where lots of goods flow north and south.
But as you said, still a lot to work out. And we'll find out whether or not what could be minor disruptions become something much more major. Brendan, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Bloomberg News Trades are Brendan Murray joining us there from London.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers, they're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern.
Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app.
Or watch us live on YouTube.
Okay, let's get a check, though, on the trade on this Tuesday. With an update on that, back over to John Tucker.
All right, the major averages, Carol, still higher right now. The advance for the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ Composite Index approaching 10% since the start of the year. After the two-day pullback, stocks, again, they were advancing today. And the best-performing stock in the S&P 500 right now, McCormick, it is up over 9% right now, closing in on 10%. Again, that's the best-performing stock in the S&P 500 after delivering an encouraging sales update. Worst-performing stock right now, that belongs to United Parcel Service, 8% lower. Their revenue target beat estimates, but Wall Street analysts kind of underwhelmed by the performance there. S&P 500, 8 points higher right now. That's up 0.2%. 52.26 on the index. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 67 points, a rise of 0.2%. The NASDAQ right now 40 points higher. That is up 0.25%. And we check the markets for you all day long right here on Bloomberg Radio. I'm John Tucker, and that is your Bloomberg Business Flash. Carol and Tim.
All right, John Tucker, so appreciate it. Hey, John, of course, breaking down the trade. Don't forget, we did get some economic points earlier today, some data points. It's a busy, chock-full week, if you will, of economic data points. We had U.S. consumer confidence holding steady in March. Americans were sanguine about their current situations, Tim, but grew slightly more pessimistic about the outlook. And then new orders placed with U.S. factories for durable goods, that rose in the month of February for the first time in 3 months, so suggesting that firms are somewhat optimistic about the direction of the U.S. economy.
On that, gold earlier extended Monday's gain ahead of key U.S. inflation data, which we get on Friday, that could provide traders with a firmer view on when the Fed will start cutting interest rates. Gold did pair most of those gains, but still near an all-time high of more than $2,200 per ounce.
All right, so with a look at kind of the broader macro environment and also the precious metal space, we welcome the president of World Markets at EverBank. He is Chris Gaffney. He's here in studio. EverBank, by the way, noting on its website, $36.2 billion in assets and $27.9 billion in deposits as of the end of 23. Chris, nice to have you in studio. How are you?
Great, thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. And I have to start, you guys think about the broad macro and things kind of coming at us. And I am curious if you have any thoughts about what's going on in Baltimore right now. We're looking once again very deeply and closely at U.S. supply chains. Right. And I'm just curious if you have any thoughts in terms of your world and how you think about it might impact potentially if we see some supply chain disruptions in terms of higher prices, inflation, and we know the story here.
Exactly. So, you know, it will definitely lead to, if anything, higher inflation and a higher inflation reading with supply chain disruptions, which could lead the Fed to stop rate cuts or actually pause on their planned rate cuts. Right now, we believe that the Fed pretty much has a predetermined rate cut path, and it's really looking for reasons to knock them off their path instead of reasons to cut. And you know, I think June is definitely on the table, and they're going to look to cut in June.
And how many do you think the Fed will do this?
Well, they're still saying three, and
not every member of the Fed,
right? And they pulled back a little bit on their 2025. I think it's really dependent on where they believe inflation, where this next PCE report comes in. They ignored the last two, and they seem to be tending to look to let inflation run hotter for longer.
Because they believe those longer term inflation expectations are anchored, right? They're sticking
right
to that.
And you know, they are in kind of a situation where with the amount of debt that we have here, they need to lower interest rates, especially before it really has an impact on the global economy.
You're talking about the cost of servicing that
debt. Exactly. That cost of servicing debt is going to take more and more of the budget, of the U.S. budget. So by lowering interest rates, they'll have less debt service cost.
It's not one of their mandates, you know, Chris.
I know. It's
hate to remind you, but
strong labor and
I didn't hear Powell say this at all during the press conference last
week. Extra mandate.
In the background, and I do believe that
many people have come on and said, U.S. debt. You know, all of a sudden, you go back 10 years, 20 years, it's like every conversation was about it.
Right.
It's gone to the wayside. But
Larry
it is kind of
brought it up this morning.
He did. He did.
And, you know, by cutting rates, they'll ease that debt service. And I really think that from what Powell was saying in his presser, they're going to let inflation run a little hotter. I think they'll adjust their inflation target. I don't think 2% is realistic, and I think they'll adjust their inflation target up. What that does to the markets, you know, is 2.5%, 3% inflation going to kill the markets? I don't think so. And I think they continue to lower rates.
Why do they have to make that adjustment? Is it because the macro factors say we're in a very different environment post-pandemic?
I think this is sticky inflation, and I think the interest rates are going to settle at a higher level than the market's expecting right now.
Because
of the higher inflation, the stickier inflation. And
because of macro, like, is it, like, what is it that's changed in our inflationary environment?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we had the supply chain interruptions, but I think in general, the economy is doing well. The labor market is very resilient. Consumers are resilient. We've got very strong U.S. consumers. They don't seem to be adjusting their spending. You know, confidence, while the longer term confidence is questionable, U.S. consumers are still very strong. So they're going to continue spending. We see services continuing to, you know, inflationary pressures on services. Any supply chain interruption, you know, that's going to add to inflationary pressures also.
So let's get to gold and precious metals.
Yeah.
Given the narrative that you just gave,
yeah,
why are we seeing gold near an all-time high?
Well, absolutely. It's kind of an inflation hedge. Mm-hmm. You know, traditionally it's shown as an inflation hedge. But what we see on EverBank's World Market Desk is individual investors concerned about the global economy. They're using it as a uncertainty hedge or a catastrophe hedge. And we're seeing people come in, individual investors come in and want to own a hard asset. One of the things that propelled gold to the record levels was central bank buying. And central banks were switching their reserves out of U.S. dollars into precious metal, into gold. And I think some of the consumers are starting to do that also. And wanting that hard asset, wanting the diversification outside of just owning their traditional asset classes.
Chris, because you do see so much on that platform, quantify it for us. Is it back to levels we saw pre-pandemic? Is it, like, give us an idea of, if you're seeing buying, how much has it kind of picked up in terms of frequency?
Well, the physical buying isn't quite back to the levels we saw, you know, post-pandemic. We went through a silver shortage and we saw spreads mm-hmm. on the physical silver widen dramatically. They're not back there yet. The spreads are narrower. Demand is up though, and we're seeing more and more demand. And talking to individuals, it's more about concern about where the global economy is and the U.S. economy. The valuations on the equity markets, you know, seeing maybe some overvaluation there, and really pushing people to have, they want to have something to hold. So we're seeing the physical precious metals. We haven't seen so much the inflows into the ETFs. It's more the physical demand.
Interesting.
Okay, what about demand for Bitcoin?
That's what I was saying.
Like, because when
same thing?
Yeah, well, when we talk about, some people come on our program and say, our bull case for Bitcoin is that this is literally digital gold.
Right, right.
Do you believe it is?
No. I still
fixed supply.
Yes.
We know how much is there.
Yeah, it's not controlled by any certain central government like fiat currencies are. So
can't melt
it does share some of those. It shares some of those. Is it a hard asset though? Is it, you know, where is it? Where is it stored? You know, there's question marks. We haven't had a Mt. Gox in a while, but, you know, questions about that, is it's in the ether. So I think for some investors, they feel it's an alternative to gold. I think the jury's out. I think it's got to establish there's a long history with gold. And so I think that is seen as the safe haven, the uncertainty hedge. People can trust that it's a hard asset. It's there in their portfolio. I still feel Bitcoin is more speculation, especially with the volatility it has.
Platform, do you?
No, we do not. We do not deal in crypto.
Yet?
We do not deal in crypto. I mean, it's, you know, we're a bank. So yeah. We're not encouraged to deal in the the crypto sphere. Right
there now. There are traditional banks getting into crypto. Sorry, go ahead, Carol.
No. Well, I was just going to save 30 seconds because you guys are a bank and you do see so much. I mean, how do you describe the economy? And forgive me because we only do have about 30 seconds left.
Not a problem. So, you know, I think the U.S. economy remains strong, mainly on the back of very strong and resilient U.S. consumers. Labor market's still good. So, you know, we'll see the higher interest rates have not had an impact yet. And I think the Fed is still going to go ahead and cut and trying to get us to this Goldilocks scenario where they can cut rates and still keep inflation down while a strong labor market. So
no stress points real quickly.
Oh, there's the debt levels and on both consumer and government is really the stress level. And that's the real question mark. And then, of course, the geopolitical tensions.
So appreciate it. Thank you so much. And for going along with us, because we know we had a lot of breaking news. Chris Gaffney, thank you. President of World Markets at EverBank, joining us in studio.
Driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, TikTok, everybody, just about 7 minutes left in the Tuesday trading session. And for a second day in a row, we're seeing some selling here into the close. We're pretty much just around our worst levels, if not at our worst levels, as John Tucker just mentioned, for the S&P Dow and the NASDAQ 100. So let's get to our Drive to the Close guest.
We got with us Leo Kelly, founder and CEO at Verdance Capital Advisors. He joins us from Hunt Valley, Maryland. Leo, good to have you back with us. Look, before we talk markets, you're joining us from just north of Baltimore, only about half an hour from the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge. We've been covering the story all day. We're thinking about everyone affected by the tragedy. Just give us an idea about how important this bridge is that crosses the Outer Harbor.
Well, it's the east side of Baltimore, and it is a significant thoroughfare. So the disruption is going to be pretty extraordinary, especially because the folks on just on either side of that bridge, the next path from one side to the other is a long, long commute. Plus, you've got the port shut down. So it's an extraordinary event. Obviously, it's at the front of everybody's mind here in Baltimore and in the surrounding area. So we're praying for the folks that are impacted both now and over the next the next couple of years. And Baltimore didn't need this break. So we're hoping this will be a quick recovery, obviously.
Yeah, we do too. And we've certainly heard from the president, from the transportation secretary and other officials saying that this is going to be certainly priority and they're going to commit whatever efforts and I guess money, it sounds like, in federal funds to get this done as quickly as possible. You know, having said that, Leo, and we know that there's still a lot to be known and there's, you know, lives that's, you know, that we're waiting to hear if there's been, you know, lives lost and so on and so forth. But it made me kind of think, you know, we live in a world where we are constantly reminding that things can come at us from unexpected directions, different magnitudes, different scale, if you will, but it kind of keeps us on our toes. And we're waiting to assess how much of this might have an impact on the U.S. supply chains and a lot to be known. And obviously, the longer it's a problem, the longer it or the higher potential for it to become a supply chain problem. Having said that, how do you think about kind of where we are in this market environment? Does it feel tenuous at all? Does it feel like sure-footed? How do you see it?
It does feel a little bit tenuous, you know, today's activity aside. It does feel a little bit tenuous. And I think it feels tenuous because you have a pocket of the market that's running up to extraordinary levels. I think the last time we were on, we were talking about some of the AI bubble that was brewing. And we're really at this interesting tug of war right now. The Fed is still trying to battle back inflation. Inflation is being very persistent. And we've talked about this before. It's just because there's so much capital flushing around in the system. So the market is excited about the fact that the economy is being resilient. It's excited about the fact that inflation has slowed. But I would stress, slowing inflation is still inflation. And the Fed is still fighting it. So I think one of the challenges that the economy has, that the market has, is that when the Fed gets more aggressive, inflation does slow, but then we start to see an economy showing danger signals. So the Fed slows down or stops rates. I mean, this concept of six rate cuts this year, I always thought was absurd, because as soon as you start to get the least bit dovish, the inflation numbers start to signal higher again. So this is going to be an interesting tug of war with valuations higher. And we haven't had much volatility since October. I do think this is a time for discipline, quite frankly.
Hey, Leo, very briefly, what are some of those warning signs that you're starting to see, if any, right now?
Well, I think you have a mixed message around the economy. Small business confidence has been down. Inflation is going back up. We get mixed messages with the ISM surveys versus the employment numbers. So I think that's one of the first challenges, right? Some of the lead indicators. So really what's interesting about this current economic data that's coming out is anybody who wants to come to a conclusion can find the data. If you want to be positive, you can find the data. If you want to be negative, you can find the data. Where I'm concerned is that inflation has remained persistent.
Got it.
And the Fed keeps talking about the fact that they're going to cut rates and they just start to get a little more dovish.
Okay. Forgive us, Leo. We've got to run. We'll check in with you soon. Leo Kelly, founder and CEO at Verdant Capital Advisors there in Maryland.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.